From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! On today's program, Ralph Nader talks about what's at stake in today's elections. Activists from around the country discuss the issues that are or are not mobilizing voters in their areas. And voting rights workers describe the obstacles some people face when they opt, after all, to go to the polls. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, sitting in for Amy Goodman this week. I'm Laura Flanders. First, these headlines. Americans began voting today in state and congressional polls. 34 Senate seats, 36 governorships, and all 435 seats in the House of Representatives are at stake. We'll have a lot more on this later in the show. Meanwhile, the U.S. is once again threatening a military attack on Iraq, reportedly over the issue of weapons inspectors. President Clinton says no option is being left off the table. Meanwhile, Secretary of Defense William Cohen has been off for Europe and the Persian Gulf. Just where he's stopping remains a mystery. The White House won't say what countries Cohen is going to or exactly what he'll discuss. Iraq says it's cutting off contact with UN arms inspectors because the United States is blocking any reference to lifting sanctions in a review of Iraqi compliance with UN resolutions. Hundreds of people marched through Baghdad, the Iraqi capital, today, carrying the coffins of children they say have died because of those sanctions. Though the U.S. has historically had no problem acting unilaterally in launching airstrikes, Gulf allies have been reluctant to support recent American military action against Iraq. Saudi Arabia recently refused to sanction U.S. airstrikes from their soil. In the latest development in the Middle East negotiations, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today postponed a cabinet meeting during which the Y Accord, was to have been ratified. Netanyahu said he ordered the delay because the Palestinians have not submitted a complete blueprint for fighting terrorism, but he would not say what was missing from the so-called security plan. Implementation of the agreement cannot begin until it has been approved by Israel's cabinet and the parliament. The original start-up date for the agreement was to have been this past Monday. The Palestinians reacted angrily to Netanyahu's decision to postpone the cabinet meeting, which had been scheduled for this week. Saying his country faces a panorama of death, desolation, and ruin, the president of Honduras is appealing to the world for help. Along with neighboring Nicaragua, Honduras is reeling from Hurricane Mitch and its aftermath. Officials estimate the storm killed 7,000 people in Central America, 5,000 in Honduras. The Red Cross is tripling its appeal. That agency is now asking for nearly $7.5 million to help storm victims, and other aid organizations are also organizing help shipments. A French judge yesterday issued an international warrant for the arrest of Chile's former dictator Augusto Pinochet, who is under police guard in a London hospital awaiting a ruling on an arrest warrant from Spain. The French warrant was issued by investigating judge Roger Leloir in connection with his investigation into the disappearance of three French citizens during Pinochet's rule in the 70s. The investigation was ordered last week by the Paris State Prosecutor's Office, which must now formally demand Pinochet's provisional arrest pending a formal request for his extradition. Justice authorities said they expected the prosecutor's office to act within 48 hours. A week after Brazil helped broker a peace accord between Peru and Ecuador, a state firm is to sell $2 million of arms and parts to both of those countries. This according to a Brazilian news weekly. Brazil's foreign ministry says it had information about the sale but has not commented in any public way. Six Houston police officers involved in the fatal shooting of a Mexican national this last summer have been fired. Pedro Oregon died in a hail of bullets after the officers, members of a so-called gang task force, raided his apartment on the city's southwest side in search of drugs July 12th. A police internal affairs investigation found that Oregon was struck by 12 of the 30 bullets fired and that he was armed but had not fired his weapon and no drugs were found. The investigation revealed that the shooting started when one officer accidentally shot a colleague in the back. The officers didn't have a warrant to search Oregon's apartment, and the investigation concluded that they had violated police policy and various state and federal laws. The firing of the six officers came just 2 weeks after a grand jury decision that only one of them should be indicted on a criminal trespass charge. The 2,000 off-camera employees of ABC who walked off their jobs in a one-day strike over health benefits were uncertain today whether they would be able to return to work as planned. The network said the camera operators, couriers, and other employees would be locked out until they promised to give ABC warning of future strikes. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Laura Flanders. Stay tuned for our program, which is going to focus, obviously, on the elections. And this is Democracy Now! Today, as around the nation, candidates are taking their photo ops at their local polling places. And the burning question is just how many of their fellow citizens will actually join them in the voting ritual that continues to lose luster for the majority of Americans. Just as campaign spending continues to soar, this year approaching the $1 billion mark, analysts are predicting that less than 40% of Americans will vote at all. This year, the pundits concede they could be surprised, though. It wasn't but a few weeks ago that the major media were predicting that so-called Monica Gate would have dire consequences for Democrats and completely marginalize President Clinton from the national political scene. And what's President Clinton done? Well, he's demonstrated his keen ability to reinvent himself. He's made himself over at least twice since, first as a broker of Mideast peace and most recently as the chief cheerleader for getting out the African-American vote, which is essential, of course, for the Democrats to stem the Republican tide that's been rising since they took Congress for the first time in 40 years in 94. It is, by all accounts, an election of extremes. While 50 House races are considered too close to call, 96 out of 435 are running uncontested. And most of those seats belong to Republicans. At least 8 of the 34 Senate seats that are up this time are now too close to call. Predictions that the GOP would pick up 5 net Senate seats, those are the 5 needed to give them that magic 60 number of seats and the ability to cut off floor debate, well, that prediction's been downsized now to a gain of just 2 or 3. In the final days, Senator Carol Mosley Brown of Illinois, who was trailing badly throughout the campaign, has now seen her race with former state Senator Peter Fitzgerald tighten right up. In California, the latest polls show a statistical dead heat between incumbent Democrat Senator Barbara Boxer and State Treasurer Matt Fong. In New York, the race is similarly tight, and we're going to be looking all over the country at races like these, state-level governor races, and just what it is that's mobilizing people or failing to get them to the polls today. Helping us, first off, to try to get the argument of what exactly is at stake today is Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader is known to most of you, I would imagine, as a consumer advocate and former presidential candidate. It wasn't so long ago he was almost synonymous with third-party candidacies and really kind of calling a pox on both the major parties' houses. Ralph, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Obviously, you're not calling for people to abandon the major parties this time around, or are you?
Well, I'm calling for them to consider alternatives, third-party alternatives, including any races where there are Green Party candidates, as in 2 congressional districts in New Mexico, the 5th congressional district in Pennsylvania, in New York, in Maine, and other states. What's interesting is that the races have two characteristics. Either the 2 major parties, Republican and Democrat, are conceding each other's races. For example, in Connecticut, the Democrats are conceding the governor's race, stranding Barbara Kennelly, the Democratic candidate. The Republicans are conceding the Senate race to Senator Dodd. And you see that characteristic a great deal around the country. That's why, as you say, there are almost 100 congressional seats where the major party that is out of office isn't fielding a candidate to challenge the incumbent. And in a particularly egregious case of that surrender of any obligation to give the voters a two-party competitive system, in the 5th Congressional District in Pennsylvania, that's in northern Pennsylvania, the incumbent is a Republican first-termer. He has no Democratic opposition on the ballot. There is a Green Party candidate, Bill Belitskis, who is the only alternative on that ballot. The other types of races, as you indicated, are closely contested. But one of the reasons why they're so closely contested is that the agendas of the two candidates are almost similar. You notice how the Democrats are throwing themselves on the public, saying they're for a balanced budget, they're for tax cuts, they're for a variety of what was formerly considered a Republican agenda. And then the Republicans are saying that they are for patients' rights, they are for protecting Social Security. And most of the issues are within a range of about 5 themes, whereas major issues are being ignored, such as the overriding power of corporations to corrupt our politics, control or own our media, corporatize our universities, and defraud our consumers.
Well, it's exactly for reasons like that that many people will be, as I mentioned, staying away from the polls this time. Do you think that the sort of cynicism about what options are out there explains the low turnout completely?
Well, nothing explains the low turnout by my standards. I think anybody who does not vote, and by that I mean vote for anybody they want to vote, including, for example, I voted just recently absentee vote, and there were two candidates, two offices on the ballot that had two candidates I didn't like. So I just wrote in who I wanted up at the top. I think everybody should vote.
Well,
I think not voting is a cop-out. Cynicism is a symptom of withdrawal, which creates power vacuums filled by the rascals.
Well, there are people also, of course, in this election that say, unlike others, this is one where people really need to hold their noses more tightly than ever and send a clear message to the Republican Party about what they think of the Ken Starr investigation. That's a view that Michael Moore and others have been proposing almost as an act of, as they're referring to it, as a sort of civil disobedience. What do you make of that campaign?
But nobody counts you when you don't vote.
But as far as this campaign to vote for the Democrats across the ticket, no matter what, to send a message to the Republicans about the Starr investigation, what do you make of that effort that seems to have mobilized a lot of people in the last few weeks?
Well, I mean, that is a difference, a reasonable difference of philosophy. I mean, if you take the least of the worst parties or candidates, then you'll go out and you'll vote holding your nose for either Republican or Democrat, depending on your views. I think we're beyond that in this country. I think the rot of the two-party system, the money corruption, the cowardliness, the subservience to corporate power throughout our society merits alternative political parties and alternative agendas. And you just don't get those underway unless some people value their vote to be on the frontier, value their vote to send a message to the two parties by denying them the vote and having it counted in another visible column in a third-party realm.
Well, Michael Moore and others have said on this network that that argument holds true often, but in this case, this is a special election where there are overriding issues having to do with a essentially illegal effort by the Republican hard right to undermine an elected presidency through a sort of sex-focused witch hunt.
Well, I mean, who gave him the fodder for that? President Clinton. He didn't have to get into that. It was of his own making. And obviously, he knows that the Republicans are going to make political hay with it, but they're going nowhere on that. Even if they impeach him in the House, there's no way he's going to be convicted in the Senate.
Well, to go right from the other perspective, from the national to the local, I'd like to bring on another guest, Phil Wiledo, who is founder of the Job is a Right campaign in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He's also the author of The Feeding Trough, which was an investigative report on the school choice and welfare reform issues in that state. Phil Wiledo, we're talking national politics and local. Which takes priority in your view this morning as you consider voting in this day's elections?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, in Wisconsin, you've got a combination of both. A friend, Newt Gingrich, was out here the other day to attend a Packers game, and which they tried to turn into a political rally. And he was quoted in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as saying that that he has looked to Wisconsin for examples of social policy that he's tried to implement nationally, and specifically cited welfare reform and school choice. Those are the two issues that Wisconsin has become most noted for, developing the most draconian and repressive welfare reform program, W-2, and going the farthest in funding a school choice program, so-called school choice program, that essentially drains money from the public school system for a variety of private non-sectarian and religious schools. Well, those programs are part of what has made Wisconsin what even the local paper here refers to as a national laboratory for social programs. And as you know, as we pointed out in the report, The Feeding Trough, both of those programs were heavily pushed and funded by the country's leading right-wing foundation, the Bradley Foundation here in Milwaukee. The issues of W-2 and school choice are part of the governor's campaign on both candidates, and it comes up in various ways among the other candidates. But I don't think it's being addressed in a way that has really exposed the issues that are at stake and the implications for those programs for working people in general, and particularly for the communities of color.
So, not to be too crass about it, but what will you be urging your colleagues to do today?
Well, we basically told people that, you know, that we believe that activism is the answer, and that the electoral arena, as you pointed out, is influenced by almost $1 billion in funds, and that to put all our eggs into that basket would be a mistake. Would basically be fighting on the in a turf that in which we are pretty much guaranteed not to win. On the other hand, the right to vote is something that's been fought for in this country for many years through the suffragist movement, through the civil rights struggle. People have died for it. It's still a contested right in many communities. And we don't tell people not to vote. If people feel that there's a candidate they feel that they must support, go out and do that. There's candidates that I personally, you know, may feel comfortable with supporting. As a activist organization, we need to point out that it's not who holds elective office that's the key. It's what type of social movement is in the streets.
Well, to listen to to both of you, Phil Wiledo and Ralph Nader, the sound couldn't be more different from what we're hearing. That is really one single chorus in mainstream media, which is about this election turning on the national question, the investigation into Bill Clinton's personal life. What do you make, Ralph, of this disconnect between the concerns that your colleagues and Phil's articulate and this national dialogue that would have you believe that all voting decisions are being made on the basis of what's happening inside the Washington Beltway?
Well, because there are two political cultures operating. Inside the Washington Beltway, the politicians always jockey for supremacy, and they see the Clinton-Lewinsky debacle as a good tool to use, the Republicans against the Democrats. They know, as well as everybody else, that the vast majority of the American people are tired of it. They don't see it as a momentous constitutional issue, and they want other problems in the society to be addressed. I think the one of the more interesting races now is the one in Wisconsin between Senator Russ Feingold and the Congressman Mark Newman. Here's a Senator Russ Feingold who, on a basis of principle, turned down probably $2 million of outside soft money to batter his opponent with. He unilaterally disarmed himself, so to speak, and he went from a 20-point advantage 3 months ago to a very, very close race, where even he may be slightly behind.
Right.
Now, if he loses based on that issue, that's going to be a very serious blow to the campaign around the country to initiate federal campaign finance reform.
Ralph Nader, Phil Willeta, we're going to come right back with you in 60 seconds. Stay tuned. Listening to Democracy Now!, sitting in for Amy Goodman. I'm Laura Flanders. With us on the line is Ralph Nader and also Phil Willeta. Coming back to you, Ralph, on today's election ballots, many will find not just the who to vote fors, but the how to vote questions on many, many ballot measures. Some states like California, it's a kind of dizzying array of ballot measures. Which few stand out in your mind as deserving particular attention, Ralph, today?
Well, one in California is the 50-cent tax on cigarettes, tobacco products. That one is a very close one. It was the tobacco companies actually up front opposing it. They weren't using front groups this time on their television ads. And the other one is Prop 9, which I have supported, along with Consumers Union, the Sierra Club, and the League of Women Voters in California, that would eliminate some of the huge charges that came from legislation in 1996 in electricity deregulation on utility ratepayers, residential utility ratepayers. One of the most amazing things of the 1996 bill was that after giving the utilities a huge advantage to be subsidized once again for their inefficient nuclear plants and other investments in a new era of competition against their so-called competitors, which have never emerged to date, the politicians said they had to give the ratepayers a 10% rate reduction, and then made the ratepayers finance their own rate reduction by having the utilities issue bonds, which the ratepayers on their monthly bill paid the principal and interest for. I mean, anything more brazen than that I have not seen in the electricity deregulation area. So there's a big battle over Proposition 9, and the utilities have spent $45 million on television ads, and our side has no money on television ads.
And coming to you, Phil Willeta, what do you make of the whole debate these days about ballot measures? Some are saying and have always said that this is the way for popular politics to articulate itself at the electoral level. Others have said that it's a way to make politics without dispute, without debate, without legislative discussion. Where do you stand on that?
Well, on the one hand, it's a way for people to circumvent politicians and supposedly big money and speak directly to the issues. On the other hand, California has been the arena for many of the most important initiatives, and they've resulted in the overturn of affirmative action and severe legislation directed against immigrants, bilingual education. And I think you're still dealing with the question of an arena in which money plays the primary factor. If I could comment on what you had raised a little bit earlier in terms of the impact on the elections of the Starr investigation.
Yes, please.
It's probably bewildering to most people. I think it has been to most of us on how this thing spiraled almost out of control and has just dominated the political agenda in so many different ways. And if you look at it on the different sides that are lined up on it, I really think it has a lot more to do than just partisan bickering or an attempt to undermine a Democratic president by Republican opponents and so on. The whole right-wing agenda for the last 15, 20 years has been to, as much as possible, completely deregulate the economy, to eliminate any possible obstacle to profit-making, in weakening labor laws, environmental laws, antitrust laws, as well as to dismantle the social programs like affirmative action and women's rights and civil rights legislation, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, all of the gains that activist movements, the labor struggles of the 30s, the civil rights struggles of the 60s, the women's movement, the lesbian gay movement have made. And the Democrats, because of their electoral base, have been a weak opposition to some of that. It was, of course, President Clinton who signed the Welfare Reform Act of 96, which was probably the biggest piece in that deregulation strategy. But they have dragged their heels a little bit here and there on certain issues. And so I view the Starr investigation, and of course Starr is a part of the whole right-wing firmament. He used to be a Bradley lawyer and argued the school choice cases here for the state of Wisconsin. He's tied in with that whole network of foundations and think tanks supported by the corporations. But I think the mass movement is at a relatively low level, and the on the world arena, the socialist camp has collapsed, and that was the main opposition to underfettered capitalism. I think that the corporate class in this country has just said there's no need for any type of concession, any type of program that was won through struggle. We're going to take it all back. Mm. And this sort of completely sweeping away of respect for the results in elections is a part of that. But I don't think the Democrats are an effective opposition. That's why we would push the true defense for democracy in this country and for justice is a reactivation of a grassroots people's movement.
Thank you, Phil Waledo, the founder of Job is a Right campaign in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Last comment from you, Ralph, before we move on. Ralph Nader.
Yeah, so I think there's got to be a broader public discourse on the political responsibilities of citizens. I think that they're being pandered to, they're being flattered, they're responding with cynicism and withdrawal instead of skepticism and resurgence to take their part in strengthening our democracy. I think that's got to be a discussion among citizen groups. They've got to start asking themselves, what are they doing to this country by staying home, by saying there's no hope, by privatizing their public concerns, and in effect by dropping out of democracy. Mm-hmm. And we're waiting for the candidates who will fulsomely put that on the agenda instead of engage in the flattery that they're engaging in.
Ralph Nader, consumer advocate, former presidential candidate, thank you so much for being with us here on Democracy Now! We're going to move from the large national picture more and more local stories for the rest of the program, and we'll begin at the state level, where all eyes will be on Texas, where Governor George W. Bush is predicted to rack up an impressive victory, with the key question really being how well his new age type Republicanism is playing with the state's huge Hispanic and Latino population, whom he has courted heavily. His ability or failure to woo that key constituency is being considered a kind of bellwether for the GOP after capitalizing on immigrant bashing. The GOP appears to understand now that they must appear to change course, because the fastest group of voters are, in fact, Latinos. Lydia Camarillo, who's with us on the line right now, is executive director of the Southwest Voter Registration and Education Project that has as one of its projects an effort to get out the vote in the Latino community. With us also on the line is Abdi Soltani from California. We're going to go there next. But let's start with you, Lydia. What exactly will you be doing today, and what challenge do you think you face?
Well, today is election day, and so the challenge for Texas and other states is to make sure that we have the highest possible turnout. But as we all know, the turnout across the board for all electorate is going to be quite low, especially in Texas, where there really aren't any competitive races, or people feel that the race is over and has been over for a while at the top of the ticket. And so that's the challenge for all voters, and certainly for the Latino vote, and that's what we're working on today across the state.
And what do you make of this sort of new age Republican approach to the Hispanic and Latino population? Do you think it'll fly?
Well, I think so. I think that Governor Bush has been quite smart, and if today at the end, at the 11th hour, when we see how he does with the Latino vote, I think we'll see that he'll have a high percentage of turnout for him compared to other GOP candidates. But I think what's important is that Governor Bush can be and will be the leader of how the Republicans need to start thinking about, which is to stay away from wedging issues. I think the question will be if, in fact, the governor not only wins and wins a high portion of the Latino electorate, but will he be able to maintain a moderate position once he has to start campaigning, although he claims he isn't for president and the candidate of choice for the GOP? How does he compromise with the his statewide agenda as a moderate Republican compared to the local conservative districts such as Gingrich, who his district is white conservative, or Lamar Smith, which there's few to no Latinos in those districts, and they can afford to be very conservative.
What are the big turning point issues as you see them?
The turning point issues continue to be a bilingual education, affirmative action, services to the elderly, all those issues that have to do with the immigrant community as well as American citizens. We're no different than any other electorate, but it's how we are approached. And in the 96 presidential election, when Dole and Kemp were campaigning in California and decided to adopt the Pete Wilson strategy of adopting 187, that's when a flag was sent to all Latinos, and you saw nationally a high number of Latinos voting for Clinton. And in Texas, a Republican state, you saw 81% of the Latino vote casting their vote for Clinton. The question will be, can that be done here? Governor Bush has been very smart, not only speaks the language, has been aggressively targeting El Paso and the Valley and other areas where there's a high proportion of Latinos. And more importantly, when 187 was passed, he clearly said, no way in will you see in Texas what you see in, or saw in California. And so Latinos are really smart about that. So if he wins a high percentage this time, the test will be in the 2000 as to how he reacts, and will he continue to have the same posture that he's forging now. And I think the GOP is clearly putting on their brakes at their strategies. You don't see any real wedging edge propositions in California in a general election. You saw it in a primary when there's less turnout.
Well, we're going to go to California next, to Abdi Sultani, who's an organizer with Californians for Justice, a young man with a long history working against propositions like 187, the anti-immigrant proposition, and anti-affirmative action initiatives that have, as you said, been on the ballot in the last years in California. Abdi, we're talking about new voters, increasing groups of voters. What are your priorities today, you and the co-workers at Californians for Justice?
Well, I think that 1994 was really a major political earthquake in California, and now 4 years later, we're still feeling the aftershocks. In 1994, although nearly half of the state population were people of color, only 19% of the voters were. And a lot of my friends outside of California would ask me, how is it possible that California would pass an initiative like Proposition 187, which was anti-immigrant? And what a lot of people don't understand outside of the state is that even though the state's population is vastly diverse, the electorate in 1994 was still overwhelmingly white. By 1996, we saw the electorate increase from 19% of the voters being people of color to 25% in the November election where Proposition 209 was contested. And by this June's primary, it increased from 19% in 94 to 31% of the voters being people of color. So in just 4 years, there's been a major change in the face of who votes in California. And I think what will be very interesting at the end of today's election is how much of that gain will be sustained. How much was it because of issues like 209 in 96? And how much because of the attack on unions and bilingual education in the June primary did people come out to vote? Or is it part of a larger trend that's going to sustain itself, and we think that that's what's going on?
Well, of course, at the state level, the race between Senator Barbara Boxer, the Democrat, and State Treasurer Matt Fong is, as far as we can see, a dead heat. Is that a race that has mobilized people, motivated people, or are you seeing more attention to local issues, that sort of plethora of ballot initiatives and the many, many local candidates who are running?
Well, the Matt Fong versus Barbara Boxer campaign for state senate, I think the most interesting thing about it is how Matt Fong's connection to right-wing organizations backfired on him. It was disclosed that he had given a $50,000 donation from his state treasurer campaign to an organization called the Traditional Values Coalition, which is one of the major right-wing organizations in California that's anti-gay and anti-abortion. And this really became the scandal in this year's election, was Matt Fong, who's painting himself as a moderate, but his real connections to these right-wing, pretty sinister forces. And what's interesting to us about that is that in 1994, the big issue was immigration. In 96, it was affirmative action. And the right-wing used those as wedge issues to attack our communities. But in this election, the political arena seems to have changed, where Matt Fong's support of an anti-gay, anti-abortion organization has become more of an issue than some of the racist attacks that the Republican Party had originated in the past.
Coming back to you for a moment, Lydia Camarillo, listening to what Abdi Soltani has to say, what do you think are the parallels in Texas, and what do you make of organizing constituencies as you do? Do you think there are drawbacks, problems to assuming that there is a kind of homogeneity in the way that certain ethnic or racial groups vote?
Well, there is some of that, but I think that it is true that there's a dramatic growth since 1994. I think that there's certainly in the Latino electorate, both in Texas and in California, you see almost 500,000 in each state of new registered voters or registered voters since 1994. A part of that profile includes naturalized citizens who, frankly, have lived here legally for anywhere from 5 to 50 years and felt comfortable with paying their taxes, paying their dues, raising their families. And at the 11th hour, when they start seeing the political shift of attacking the immigrant community, they thought that the only way they could respond was by naturalizing and voting. So I think you're going to continue to see a shift both of the Latino electorate and other minority groups using their vote as a ticket to accountability, unlike you've seen before. And you're also going to see, that's what I meant earlier when we were talking about how the GOP has pretty much put its brakes on its approach to how they bring out the vote. And one of the strategies was to attack the community, the communities through Prop 187, 209, and even the initiatives 226 and 227 in the primaries, but not in the general. So what I think you're going to see is a really long effort by the GOP to try to figure out how it's going to capture at least some of the vote of this new piece, whether if they want to stay in power. In California, for instance, in the year 2000, the Latino vote share of the vote will be 15%. In Texas, 20%. That's a dramatic number that was not anticipated. And the GOP should have been watching and looking, but had kept its eyes closed, believing that the Latino vote and other minority electorates didn't care.
Well, just one to pick up on that, while your focus is on the GOP, do you really feel that the Democratic Party has done such a good job of actually reaching out to these voters, or have they been relying on the old assumption that those voters will have nowhere else to go?
Well, I think there's been a lot of taking for granted approach. I mean, I think even the Latino electorate was quite upset at Clinton when he signed the welfare reform initiative. But I think that when you see real parties competing for a vote, then neither party can afford to take the Latino or other electorates for granted. So that's a positive for democracy. It's forcing those two parties, as well as in some states like California and New Mexico, where the third party is increasingly becoming very strong. It's forcing everyone to really have a real discourse about what democracy is, but more importantly, really implementing it and living it in a way that we haven't seen before. America can only be better if all electorate who are part of this country are really participating in, and Latinos are clearly going to be part of the decision-making, and we aren't taking anything for granted, and we expect not to be taken for granted.
Lydia Camarillo from San Antonio, the Southwest Voter Registration and Education Project. Last word from you, Abdi Soltani, with Californians for Justice. You've got about 30 seconds.
I think that the getting people out to vote today and in every election is critical. But as progressives, we can't fool ourselves to think that voting and who votes equals political power. Let's face it, a few people still control what we vote on, who we vote for, when we vote, and who votes in terms of who has the power to determine those things. So really we have to look at voting as one strategy for organizing our communities to take power over the many decisions that affect all of our futures.
Abdi Soltani, thank you so much, an organizer with Californians for Justice. You are listening to Democracy Now! Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders. We'll be back with you in just 60 seconds. Well, following on what Abdi Soltani just said, that voting is not the be-all and end-all of politics, nonetheless, it is a right that people have had to fight for. And many Americans still really remember, as they approach the polling booth, have memories of police dogs and arrests and terror tactics used by the power structure to keep them away from those polling stations during the Civil Rights Movement. Voter intimidation, though, is not a thing of the past, and in many predominantly African-American communities, voter intimidation is still used to discourage the black vote. It takes many forms, from threats of prosecution to police harassment, videotaping. The Department of Justice has sent investigators out to 12 states this year where they have received complaints that minority, so-called minority voters, are targeted for voter intimidation. Civil rights activists also point to other forms of disenfranchisement, such as the exclusion of candidates through campaign financing, and we've mentioned that here already on this program. To look at some of these issues about political rights, we're going to go now to activists in South Carolina, in Alabama, Kentucky, and elsewhere. Let's start with Reverend J.M. Fleming, who is in Greenville, South Carolina. He is the chairperson of Concerned Citizens for Equal Justice and a longtime activist who is leading an effort in Greenville to get the black community to vote. Starting with you, Reverend Fleming, what will you be doing? What have you been doing already this morning?
Well, this morning what we've been doing is trying to get people out to the polls and trying to organize ourselves and telling them what to vote for and what our rights are. In South Carolina, we are today on the ballot. We are still fighting with a person who have 1/8 Negro blood. It's unlawful to marry anybody of white persuasion. Those are kind of issues that we are still fighting with in South Carolina, not only intimidation by police and threats from other folk that we have to deal with. We are still trying to fight for some just basic, decent human rights in South Carolina. Exclusions from the polls through the process, economic process, exclusion from the polls through intimidation, all kinds of tactics are going on in South Carolina. But nevertheless, we are out here, and we're not going any place, and we're here to fight. We're fighting for our rights. To vote. We've shed blood. Folk have died for it. We're not going to give it up.
Now, you're facing a pretty interesting, you're involved in a pretty interesting race there in South Carolina where the Republican Governor Beasley is in a very Republican state, but he's in a very tight race with Jim Hodges, the Democrat. Isn't that right?
Sure. Well, what is happening here in this state, remember, under the Beasley's administration, they've diluted the school system. Matter of fact, they're trying to get rid of the public school system and excluding blacks from education. They've cut back on all kind of Pell Grants. They've done everything they could to keep blacks from moving forward in education under Beasley. We've gone down below two states since Beasley been in office.
So the issues for your voters as you see them are both statewide. And is there also concern about national politics, the national picture?
Sure, we have great concern about our national picture as we look at what the Republican Party is trying to do to Bill Clinton. We understand that it's not our concern of his personal life, yet I have issues with it when it hits the public, but that ought to be between he and Hillary, and it shouldn't have anything to do with his job performance. And I don't see it as having an effect upon his job performance.
Mm-hmm. Now, to get back to the question of voter intimidation, there have been a lot of rumors flying around in your area, including the rumor that there might be police officers showing up at the polls. Is that right?
It has been rumored that, and that's why we're out here this morning. That's why we have extra folk at the different polls and whatnot to try and prevent any of that.
Now, the police would be there to do what?
Well, some have said come to serve warrants on folk who would possibly show up at the polls and whatnot, and we're talking to the police chief and others, administrators, to warn that, to stop them from doing that kind of thing this morning. So we've gotten from the mayor and said the mayor said that would not take place here in the city of Greenville this morning. So we're out just to make sure what the mayor has said to us takes place.
The police might use it as an opportunity to serve warrants on people with outstanding warrants.
That's right.
Well, we're going to go to Ann Braden next. She's a co-chair of the Southern Organizing Committee for Economic and Social Justice and also a civil rights and social justice activist for very many years. She's been active in both Kentucky and Alabama. Kentucky has two very tight races to watch, the Senate and the House. Will the outcomes of those races be your concern, Ann, or will you be focusing more concretely on the nuts and bolts of actually getting people to the polls?
Well, I think it's both. I think that, actually, I do think a lot of people are concerned about this election that maybe haven't been in some previous elections, because you don't always see that much difference between the Democrats and Republicans. That's been said many times, or between the candidates. I think there are differences, but, you know, you can make a case that way. But I think I do believe there are more people concerned about this election because of the national picture. We have some very important local races also. But what we've been saying to people, whether we like it or not, because the media is going to do this, this election is going to be seen as a referendum on what's been happening in Washington over recent months.
And what do you think stands in the way of voters in Kentucky, for example, going out and casting their votes? You've got experience there. What have you seen in the past?
Well, we're not so-called deep South state or that kind of thing. We've traditionally, historically been a border state, whatever that means. But we have definitely had intimidation of the African-American vote in this town, very specifically. And indications that might happen today. There's certainly been an effort to keep it from happening.
What kind of thing do you mean when you say intimidation? What does that look like for people approaching the voting booth?
Well, you can't escape recent history. In 1995, we elected a governor who's now governor of Kentucky, Governor Patton, and the African-American vote came out in force. The west end of Louisville, which is predominantly African-American, not entirely. I'm white. I live there, and some other people do, but it's mainly African-American, really turned out that year in great numbers, organized by the A. Philip Randolph Institute, which is an African-American labor organization, for years has been trying to get the vote out, and labor unions, and the churches cooperated, so there was a big vote. That vote elected our present governor. That's not just our opinion. That's the reporters said that, you know, that was the margin of victory. It wasn't a very big margin, and that's what made the difference. In the wake of that, there was so-called investigations, actually by our liberal newspaper, so-called, to start with, the Courier Journal, see if there'd been fraud in that election. Then the defeated Republican candidate got all upset, said that he had evidence that votes had been stolen all over Kentucky and all that, and called for an investigation, whereupon the Attorney General instituted a grand jury, was convened. This went on for, well, ever since, now in 1998, of a huge investigation of that turnout, where they, let me tell you what they did, they interviewed, is a polite term for it, the state police did, hundreds, literally hundreds, of young African Americans, like teenagers, who had been recruited as volunteers to get out. Well, they might have gotten a little $20 stipend, but mostly volunteers to help get the vote out that day. It was a wonderful thing. Got kids, you know, interested. And people say, well, get them interested in doing something, so they do constructive things and not destructive things. Here they were doing it. Then the state police come around to question them. And it did intimidate. You know, it had an effect. I mean, of people maybe not being scared to death, so I won't get messed up that mess again. And you know what? It really was, and turned out, you know, they didn't come up with any evidence of stolen votes or anything else. There's still a question of whether the winning candidate went over a spending limits bill we have, you know, that kind of thing. But the point was, it was an effort to criminalize what was a political question. You know, I mean, you decide things like that at the polls,
mm-hmm.
and people came out. Now, that has had an effect, and I think it cut down on the turnout in the last election we had. We hope it won't today. There have been a lot of organizations, including A. Philip Randolph, that was under investigation. They thought they might be indicted. They weren't, because a lot of people raised hell, that they haven't been intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
They're out organizing today. And then we heard this week, or maybe it was late last week, that the Republicans had asked the state police to have officers all through, you know, combing the place in Jefferson County where Louisville
mm-hmm.
is. Well, we knew they weren't going to the East End where all the richer white folks live. They were going to be in the West End. And just their presence would be intimidating, you know?
And
there was a big protest about that, and the state police said they weren't going to do it. They would be on call if there were complaints, so we don't think that's happening, but only because people objected.
Well, that's one of the things I want to go to, that by protest and by response, you can change and roll back some of this intimidation. Wynette Haggins is director of Fair Representation Programs at the Southern Regional Council, which is a 80-year-old civil rights organization based in Atlanta. Wynette, you help voters who need help actually exercising their electoral rights if they come up against obstacles. What really do you advise people to do if they feel they're experiencing a problem?
Well, there's three things you can do. First, at the local and at the state level, your first response, if you feel that there's irregularities going on at your polling place or if there are efforts to intimidate voters, and there are such efforts occurring in Georgia this morning, I'm sorry to say, or at least there have been efforts by Republicans to intimidate certain voters in some 66 black Democratic precincts, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But what can the voter do? The first thing you can do, well, the best thing to do, is if you anticipate something happening, is to call the Justice Department, and I'll give you a couple of numbers in a minute. And the Justice Department, if they feel that your apprehensions are justified, can dispatch election monitors, which tends to quiet things down in polling places, believe me. But the first thing you can do if you encounter some irregularity or intimidation at a polling place is to contact your county election board and register a complaint with them. And then if still unsatisfied, and that may be the case, you should proceed to your state election board or to the election division of the Secretary of State, both offices of which will receive complaints of intimidation or voter irregularities at any time. If you're dissatisfied with the reaction or response you get from either of those alternatives, then you should contact the Department of Justice, the Voting Rights Division. And let me give a couple of phone numbers for folks out there that encounter some intimidation or voting irregularities. This one I received yesterday from the a litigator in the voting rights section. Where to call for voting rights help? The number is 202-307-2870. That's a Department of Justice number. And Cynthia McKinney gave us another Department of Justice number, the Voting Rights Division, that you can use with an 800 number. Let me read this to your listeners. It's 1-800-253-3931. Let me repeat this. If you are experiencing intimidation or voting irregularities at your polling place, this is the number of the Department of Justice to call, 1-800-253-3931. Now, it's late for the Department of Justice to do anything. In the South, the Department of Justice has already dispatched monitors to some five states. I know Selma, Alabama is one of them. I haven't got the list of the other localities where the monitors are going to be active from the Department of Justice. It is the case that it is it's late now to get any assistance from the Department of Justice, but establishing a record provides a basis for bringing in Department of Justice monitors in subsequent elections.
Could I mention one thing, Wynette, can you hear me too?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Two things I want to mention. One is, and Wynette's very familiar with this because we've worked on it together. I don't know whether everybody knows in your part of the country that there's been a massive attack and effort at intimidation on African American voters in the Black Belt of Alabama, where 10 years ago in the 80s they had brought false voter fraud charges against the organizers of the vote there, and they've been doing the same thing recently, people indicted and all that kind of thing, which is simply that's a black majority county where, and there are 10 of them in that part of Alabama where African Americans got organized and took over the majority of the governing bodies, and the old power structure just doesn't like it. And it's been there again, it's like in Kentucky, or if it's been worse, because it really down there, that it's an effort to use the criminal processes for what should be a political struggle. One other thing, let me point out, and then I'll shut up. It's interesting to me that the Republicans make no bones about it. They want to keep the electorate small. I mean, it's cloudy today. We're afraid it's going to rain. I think it may clear up. But it's been in the paper. The Republicans were hoping for rain because then you don't have a big turnout and they're more likely to win, whereas, of course, the Democrats were hoping for sunny, nice weather.
Well, I'd like to...
Now, that's criminal. Why would you know that you don't want people to vote? Do you believe in democracy or not?
Well, I'd like to ask you all to address this in our last few moments here. Obviously, disenfranchisement isn't something that only happens on voting day, and the efforts to keep an electorate small, if they are, as you suggest, don't just occur on the day that people are trying to vote. There's all sorts of ways to limit voting. And I'd like you each to address what you think stands in your way of full participation and what you think can be done, not just today, but between now and the next election to try to reinvigorate the vote and voters' options, starting with you, Reverend Fleming in South Carolina, Greenville.
There are several things that need to be done inside. I think simplicity is one of the things that we need to look at in terms of even framing the sheets to vote on. The issues that we address on those particular issues in our area, they try and make the word so sophisticated that the average person without a high school diploma or someone without a college degree can't go in and interpret what they're putting on the ballot. And so I think that we need to start looking at some simplicity. We ought to also start, the state, counties ought to start educating our folks about certain issues. We ought to address those issues. Those issues ought to come before the people prior to Election Day. Mm. Those are a couple of things that we need to do in this state. And the other thing is that we need to get rid of all forms of intimidation.
Wynette Haggins at the Southern Regional Council in Atlanta?
Right. The three things are on our agenda here. One is we need to roll back the recent decisions by the Supreme Court that outlaw the creation of black districts. One of the, majority black districts. This, in a democracy, it's essential for groups to be able to organize and elect their representatives of choice. When you defeat that proposition, you undermine the consensual basis of rule in a society, and that's what the Supreme Court has done in its Shaw decisions. So one of the things we're advocating and we're pushing for is full enforcement of the Voting Rights Act and restoration of majority-minority district. It's not an affirmative action issue. It's an issue that provides representation to voters of choice. And because of racial block voting in the South particularly, it's impossible for minority candidates to get elected without majority-minority districts. And we feel strongly that retreat on justice in voting rights has to be reversed. A second issue which concerns us deeply, and we're becoming more aware of every day.
You got 10 seconds.
Okay, more voters are disenfranchised by the operation of the campaign finance system than any other mechanism in electoral politics in America today.
Well, listen, I'd like to thank all three of you, voices that we're probably not going to hear for the rest of the day as we watch our mainstream media coverage of this election, but I think people that give you a sense of what's happening in undercovered regions of this country. Jim Fleming, Reverend Fleming, is with Concerned Citizens for Equal Justice in Greenville, and Braden comes with us from Kentucky, and Wynette Haggins is in Atlanta. We're going to repeat the number for the Justice Department Voting Rights Division, 1-800-253-3931, 1-800-253-3931. You've been listening to Democracy Now! For a copy of today's show or any other program, you can call us at 1-800-735-0233. 1-800-735-0230. Sitting in for Amy Goodman, I'm Laura Flanders.